Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I know what you're wondering. I know the burning question on everybody's heads. Am I still in my kitchen? Yes, I am. Still in the kitchen because of busyness / laziness. All right. I'm very stressed about a school that I'm visiting tomorrow. I'm really self-conscious now when I do this podcast because someone the other day complained that I spoke about too much stuff at the introduction before I spoke about Tolstoy. And so now I'm a paranoid. But I also quite like having a chat, you know. Anyway, I'm at a school tomorrow for part two of their workshop, but part one didn't go very well for reasons that were out of my control, but it didn't go very well, and it's just got me a bit rattled. So I'm stressed. So rather than putting my office back in my office, I've left it in the kitchen and just stress eaten for the day. Also, I got my first, I can't remember if I said this last night or not, but I got the first batch of War and Peace Bogan Edition Book 1. Got them in the mail. And look, I knew that these books would be a little bit unpolished, just a little bit unpolished. They're proofread, they're edited. But I thought, at the end of this whole thing, I am going to republish them as one book. But I thought it's kind of cool to publish them serialized as we go so that you can enjoy it as we go, and also so it funds, from on my end, the creation of the project exactly the same way Tolstoy did it originally. And also you get a kind of a cool collector's thing. You know, once it's a real book, you will be able to say, I've got the box set that was only in print before the project was finished, sort of thing. So I thought that was cool. And I was okay because it was sort of printing them as I go to just do one proofread and then print them. And I was fine with that. I'm like, there'll be the odd typo in there or the little mistakes grammatically or whatever. And then, I got the box, opened one up, read the first page and was like, nah, I'm proofreading this again. So I've spent the last 2 days proofreading it again. So if you ordered it in the first couple of days, there was only a handful of people that did, then, in the next 24 hours, there'll be an updated version that's listed. Now, I think most people that ordered it so far have ordered it via my website, not via Amazon, so it shouldn't make much difference because I'm just going to send out those orders as the new ones rather than the first batch. I don't think many people, if any, will actually get one of those versions that is that I'm not happy with. Also, I've been holding off on the ebook so that I can get these edits through on the ebook as well. And so that's coming quite soon. Hopefully in the next 24 hours or so, the ebook will be up. But everything's delayed, as usual with me. But now it's nice and polished. Now I'm actually really happy with it. So that's good. I'm sure there's still the odd mistake in there, but enough that it's not embarrassingly bad. The first edition was like, whenever he read it back, I was like, oh man, that's actually pretty bad. I missed quite a few spelling mistakes that were even highlighted by Microsoft Word as spelling mistakes, which is frustrating. The real hard thing about it is because I'm using a lot of Bogan slang, which aren't real words, there's heaps of little squiggly lines all through the book. And so I kind of trained myself to just ignore those because they didn't really mean much anymore because most of them were things that were intentionally spelled incorrectly. But then now I kind of skim over ones that are there correctly. Anna Karenina, Part 1, Chapter 9. Sorry about that to anyone who hates listening to me talk about anything except the current book. Anna Karenina, Part 1, Chapter 19. Quick relations reminder, please. Who is Anna in relation to Dolly and Oblonsky? I was 90% sure on this, but I did have that thought. And then I thought, well, if I've had that thought, maybe someone else listening will have that thought too. And it's always good, I think, to just clarify those little details while we go. So, Dolly has confessed everything to Anna, who says she would forgive the transgression. What are your thoughts on that? Would Anna really forgive that transgression, or is she just saying that? I Am Norwegian said, even though Stepan is a bit of a douchebag, this chapter made me like all three characters better. How ready Anna was to advocate for Stepan's forgiveness reminded me of The Sopranos. Every mob guy would have a mistress, a guma. This was tolerated by the wives as long as that invisible line Anna talked about was upheld. Dolly's previous naivety really helps explain her severe reaction to the cheating. Not that it would be understandable anyway, but Stepan knocked the innocence out of her. You know what? I had the same thought about The Sopranos reading that. How it's just, like, when, especially with that bit about the family line, and how it's, as long as that transgression is kept completely outside of the sanctity of the family unit, and has absolutely no bearing on it, the kids will never know, or that kind of thing, then it's tolerated. Yeah, I had the same thought. How funny is that? Maybe it's because I'm watching The Sopranos right now. I'm up to season 3, episode 10 or something, and I've never watched it before. So I'm right in Sopranos world. Soma Stars says, regarding Dolly's naivete, I don't see it disappearing. Her reaction to Anna's speech left me feeling like, what the F? Dolly is going to be swayed so easily to put aside her feelings. Of course, Anna would go to bat for him. They are siblings. Ah, yes. And on that note, Atomic Gecko answered my question about the relations, who's who. Anna is Steva Oblonsky's sister. Steva Oblonsky is the husband who did the cheating. Right, Steva. Stepan is also his name sometimes, and Steven, I suppose. Steva is married to Dolly, and thus Anna is Dolly's sister-in-law. Now, Kitty is Dolly's sister, and thus Kitty is Steva's sister-in-law. Formally, Kitty and Anna don't have a term in English to describe how they are related through marriage. Yeah. So, they're sister-in-law-in-laws, or sibling-in-laws-in-laws. I don't know. Yeah, I know what you mean, though. They're both... Well... They are both the uncle. They are both aunties to Dolly's children. You could say that. They both they're aunties to the children, but on other sides of the family. Techrific said, "We've been led to believe that Dolly has some natural intuition through Steva's assurances that to Levin about Kitty." We've been led to believe that Dolly has some natural intuition through Steva's assurances to Levin about Kitty. Dolly has suggested that Levin and Kitty would be a good match and furthermore hinted at real affection deep down in Kitty for Levin. So, are we supposed to see some significance in Dolly's feelings about the Karenin home? It seemed false, somehow, to her. That seems to be a very important observation, if we're to believe it is this natural insight of hers. What do you guys think? Cephalopod Surprise, awesome username, said, I don't know if I catch everything that's going on, but I got the impression that Anna was defending Steva, in part because maybe something similar is happening to her. The part where she talks about knowing her brother really loved Dolly is in his soul, and the other wasn't as important. Sounded prepared. The other girl wasn't as important. The governess. It sounded prepared. The whole draw some kind of invisible line thing seemed like something Anna thought about a lot and wasn't some heat of the moment defense for her brother. Okay, so maybe she'd pulled out those lines from her own life, from things that she'd already said in her own situation. Could be the case. Do we know if Anna has a husband? Or what's her situation? How much do we know about Anna so far? I'm incredulous that Anna would say she thinks she can forgive and as if it has never happened. Is she being disingenuous? Swim said the Mama Fishy said, I don't think she is being disingenuous, but certainly a realist. Consider this quote. Russian society was extremely patriarchal with its basis in the Orthodox Church inciting in families, the belief that men dominate every basic aspect of life, including, but not exclusively, to the workplace, community life, politics, and of course the household. Bringing customary practices into the law. Then, the Russian law code passed in 1836 under Nicholas I established the legal control the husband had over the life of his wife. According to Richard Stite's book, The Women's Liberation Movement, Feminism, Nihilism, and Bolshevism, 1860 to 1930, the wife was obliged to conform to her spouse's wishes while under his roof, to cohabit with him, and also to accompany him wherever he happened to go or be sent, the only exception being if he was sent on exile to Siberia branded as a criminal. Under this law, the husband was entitled to the children, even if they were a result of the woman having an adulterous affair with someone else. Women were also not allowed to initiate divorce proceedings and were requested to have their husbands explicitly expressed permission in order to leave the house or take a job. Women had almost no separate civil identity from that of their husband in that they needed their permission to work, study, travel, or trade, essentially prohibiting women from making any choice for herself. However, no matter how constricting marriage sounds, not marrying was a significantly worse alternative, if one was even allowed to choose. In 19th century Russia, marriage for women was essentially seen as a career goal, their ultimate purpose in life. Among nobility, these partnerships were often chosen by their parents, looking for husbands of the same or better classes as a strategy to further add to the family's social and financial status. However, in some cases, women were allowed to pick their husbands as long as they were chosen from upper-class suitable men. The full article is called Women in the 19th Century, Women in 19th Century Russia by Julietta Chevalier. Anna is giving good advice to how to live as an aristocratic married woman in 19th century Russia. Vinny Too Cool says thanks, and Nifty Rific says righto, and poor Dolly says, and the worst of it, if you understand, is that I can't leave him. There are the children. I'm tied. To leave could mean losing the rights to your children. That's such a dreadful circumstance. Well, there you go. Well, I didn't know all that stuff. Thank you very much, Swim said the My Fishy, for copying out that quote. Very oppressive for a woman in Russia at that time, probably in most of the world at that time. And marriage didn't really sound all that fun. All right, that is the discussion part of the conversation of the podcast complete. Now we will be reading chapter 20, which goes a little bit like this. The whole of that day, Anna remained at home, that is, at the Oblonsky's house, and did not receive anybody, although several of her acquaintances, who had heard of her arrival, came to see her. She spent the earlier part of the day with Dolly and the children, and sent a note to her brother to be sure and come home to dinner. "Come," she wrote, "God is merciful." Oblonsky dined at home. The conversation was general, and his wife addressed him familiarly in the second person singular, which she had not done all these days. There was still the same estrangement in their manner to each other, but no longer any question of separating, and Oblonsky saw that explanation and reconciliation were possible. Immediately after dinner, Kitty came. She knew Anna, but only slightly, and came to her sister's, not without fear of how she might be received by this Petersburg society woman, whom everybody admired so much. But she noticed at once that Anna liked her. It was evident that her beauty and youth gave Anna pleasure. And before Kitty had time to regain her self-possession, she felt not only that she was under Anna's influence, but she was in love with her, as young girls often are with married women older than themselves. Anna was not like a society woman or the mother of an 18-year-old son. The flexibility of her figure, her freshness, and that natural animation of her face, appearing now in her smile, now in her eyes, would have made her look more like a girl of 20 had it not been for a serious and sometimes even sad expression in her eyes, which struck Kitty and attracted her. Kitty felt that Anna was perfectly unaffected and was not trying to conceal anything, but that she lived in another, higher world full of complex poetic interests beyond Kitty's reach. After dinner, when Dolly had gone to her own room, Anna got up quickly and went to her brother, who was just lighting a cigar. "Steva," she said to him with a merry twinkle in her eye, and making the sign of the cross over him as she indicated the door with a look, "go and may God help you." He understood, threw down his cigar, and disappeared through the door. When Oblonsky had gone, she returned to the sofa where she had been sitting, surrounded by the children. Whether because they saw that Mama was fond of this aunt, or because they themselves felt her peculiar charm, first the two older children and then the younger ones, as is often the way with children, had even before dinner begun clinging to her, and now would not leave her side, and they started something like a game which consisted in trying to get as close to her as possible, to touch her, hold her little hand, kiss her, play with her ring, or at least touch the thrills of her dress. "Now how were we sitting before?" said Anna, resuming her seat. And Grisha again pushed his head under her arm, and leaning against her dress, beamed with pride and joy. "And when is the ball to be?" said Anna, turning to Kitty. "Next week it will be a delightful ball, one of those balls which are always jolly." "And are there any that are always jolly?" asked Anna, with tender irony. "It is strange, but there are. It's always jolly at the Bobrishevs, and also at the Nikitins, while it's always dull at the Meshkovs. Haven't you noticed it?" "No, my dear. There are no more jolly balls for me," said Anna, and Kitty saw in her eyes the peculiar world which was not yet revealed to her. "There are some that are not as difficult and dull as the rest." "How can you be dull at a ball?" "Why cannot I be dull at a ball?" asked Anna. Kitty saw that Anna knew the answer that would follow. "Because you must always be the belle of the ball." Anna had a capacity for blushing. She blushed and answered, "In the first place, I never am. But even if I were, what use would it be to me?" "Will you go to that ball?" asked Kitty. "I suppose I shall have to. Here, take this," she said, turning to Tanya, who was drawing off a ring which fitted loosely on her aunt's small tapering finger. "I shall be very glad if you go. I should so like to see you at the ball." "Well, then I have to go. I shall console myself with the reflection that I will give you pleasure. Grisha, please don't pull so hard. It is all a tangle already," she said, arranging a loose lock of hair with which Grisha was playing. "I imagine you at the ball in lilac." "Why must it be lilac?" asked Anna, half laughing. "Now, children, run away, run away. Don't you hear? There's Miss Hull calling you to tea," she went on, disengaging herself from the children and dispatching them to the dining room. "But I know why you are asking me to go to that ball. You're expecting much from it, and would like everybody to be there and have a share in it." "How do you know?" "Well, yes." "Oh, yes, it is good to be your age," Anna continued. "I remember and know that blue mist, like the mist on the Swiss mountains, that mist which envelops everything at that blissful time when childhood is just coming to an end, and its immense blissful circle turns into an ever narrowing path, and you enter the defile gladly yet with dread, though it seems bright and beautiful. Who has not passed through it?" Kitty smiled and remained silent. How did she pass through it? How I should like to know her story, thought she, recollecting the unpoetic appearance of Anna's husband, Alex Karenin. "I know something. Steva told me, and I congratulate you. I like him very much," Anna continued. "I met Vronsky at the railway station." "Oh, was he there?" asked Kitty, blushing. "What did Steva tell you?" Steva let it all out to me, and I shall be very pleased. "I travelled yesterday with Vronsky's mother," she continued, "and she talked about him all the time. He is her favourite son. I know how partial mothers are, but..." "What did his mother tell you?" "Oh, very much. And I know he is her favourite, but anyone can see how he is full of chivalry. For instance, she told me that he wished to give all his property to his brother, that already as a boy he had done something extraordinary, saved a woman from drowning, In a word, he is a hero, said Anna, smiling and remembering the 200 rubles he had given away at the station. But she did not mention the 200 rubles. For some reason, she did not like to think of them. She felt that there had been something in it relating personally to her that should not have been. She particularly wished me to go and see her, continued Anna. I shall be glad to see the old lady again, and will go tomorrow. Well, thank heaven Steva is stopping a long time with Dolly, she added, changing the subject, and she rose, dissatisfied with something, Kitty thought. I was first, no I, cried the children, who, having finished their tea, rushed back to Aunt Anna. Altogether, said Anna, laughing and running to meet them, and putting her arms round them, she tumbled the whole heap of children, struggling and shrieking joyfully, onto the floor. Alrighty, there we go, another chapter down. That was chapter 20. Have your say about chapter 20 over on the subreddit. Other than that, thank you very much for listening, and I'll see ya tomorrow.